Hey everyone, welcome to Beyond the Bio. We're glad you joined us today and excited to share a series that will not only dive deep into the stories of our exceptional leaders at Bain, but get into how we work together and how we aspire to be better as a firm through our operating principles. These core principles are what produced our outstanding results, empower our teams, and fuel the reason why we're consistently recognized as the best place to work. Join us as we break down our five operating principles through the voices of guests who live them in their everyday lives and in their careers at Bain. Joining me today is Melissa Artabain, our Executive Vice President of Global Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. We will be continuing our operating principles series by focusing on Diverse Teams, One Bain. To us, Diverse Teams, One Bain means we believe diverse and inclusive teams are our strength, and together we accomplish more than we can alone. Today we'll learn about her journey, diverse teams and collaboration at Bain, and how her passion for DEI embodies these operating principles. As a member of the working group that helped establish and live out these principles, I can't think of a better person today. Melissa, welcome to Beyond the Bio.
Thanks, Keith.
I'll also add that you and I have known each other for a while and have worked together in different paths, both officially and unofficially. So it's just personally awesome to have you here today. I had to add that, otherwise I'd regret it.
Yes, I still have the picture of Abby and Malcolm at the U of O standing next to each other before that track meet.
That's right. We did bump into each other at the Junior Olympics or one of the national track meets way back in the day.
Yeah.
So, Melissa, before we get into your personal story, which I'm excited to talk about today, I want to get into this Diverse Teams, One Bain operating principle. Can you articulate what that means and why it's so important around here?
I mean, you kind of had the official definition in that intro, and so I won't repeat that. But Diverse Teams, One Bain is really around bringing together people who have a very broad set of experiences, backgrounds, perspective, ways of thinking, skills, expertise, interests, styles. And there's so many different vectors in which people are different. And some are shaped by, I think, what we think of as traditional vectors of diversity, you know, race, gender, sexual orientation. But I think beyond that, every individual falls in a different place on all those dimensions that I just mentioned. And I think that is the power of diversity. The One Bain piece means that you have to find a way to bring that all together, right? And there's a lot of research out there that suggests that diverse teams generate better outcomes, but only if they are in an environment in which you can bring all of those different perspectives together and not cause everyone to shut down because they are so different.
Yeah, which leads to the I and the inclusion part about Bain. And we've had Maria, Brittany, Easton, and we talk about belonging, support, and trust. And that sense of belonging becomes really important for all of our people at Bain. And what does collaboration mean to you at Bain? And what does it mean for all of us at Bain? You know, Diverse Teams, One Bain is, it's a couple words, but it really does manifest itself in different ways. Did you see this a lot when you were leading case teams or in your current team now?
Yeah, I mean, wouldn't it be nice if we could all just solve our problems on our own? But I think, look, these big thorny problems, whether they're for client engagements or they're within Bain, like it really does require you to have different lenses on things.
Yep.
And push your thing and flip some things on their head. And I think, can you do that by yourself? Yes. And can you do that with people who have the same experiences and backgrounds and skills? Yes. But it's all going to feel very nice and you're not really going to go outside of your comfort zone. And I think getting to those kind of new and innovative solutions means it's going to be hard and messy and you need different people coming from different perspectives to push each other and maybe argue a little bit, but then ultimately kind of land in a place that you just wouldn't be able to land if you didn't have people who thought in a totally different way that you did.
So I want to pause there for a second because you mentioned argue a little bit. And I think the word collaboration comes into a lot of people's minds and they picture sort of everybody sitting around the table in harmony, collaborating in the ideal kindergarten classroom where everybody's sharing and nobody's upset. And that's really not how we do it here. Collaboration at Bain is willingness to take risk and put an idea out there, even if it might upset somebody at first, and then sort of kicking it around a little bit. How does that work inside Bain from your perspective?
So I think it's hard, right? And I think the research I mentioned that diverse teams will perform better also shows that it's just harder. And so I think you have to create that environment. And I think we're doing a lot within Bain to try to create the environment that celebrates that. right? And where people don't see it as a confrontational argument, but as a way of just challenging thinking. And it doesn't always work smoothly, right? But I think there needs to be a level of trust and understanding that people, we all actually are trying to get to the same outcome. We may just be pushing each other and approaching it in different ways. And I think that is key.
Yeah. And for me, that's been one of the cooler parts of getting more involved across Bain. You know, as I moved from the client side, just based here in Chicago, working with Chicago teams and now working with more of a global audience, I sort of think about it as there's a bunch of people who are planners. Right? And they like to play classical music. They like to have the script and they like to just sit down and play exactly what's on the sheet. And the way a lot of the problems we're talking about, especially when you and I are working together, it's kind of like jazz. Like, I'm going to bring my instrument, you bring your instrument. They really don't belong together in a band, but we're going to sit down and play for as long as it takes to come up with a good song.
Yes. Yes. And then not everyone's going to like that song.
Right. And that's the other challenge. But the good news is it tends to climb the charts and we continue to make good progress here. But that approach to things, it's definitely not easy. And it's certainly easier to play with people that you've played with before and to play music that you're all familiar with. And when somebody new shows up or brings a new instrument or a new idea, creating can be a challenge. And that's not easy.
Yeah, it can be a challenge. And you have to create the environment in which someone isn't so distracted and using so much energy that they can't contribute, right? They can't just show up with their instrument and look around and feel like, oh gosh, like I don't belong here. And so I don't know what I should play and be hesitant in playing. If they're hesitant in playing, they're not going to be contributing to the song, right?
So that's right. Getting that environment right, not just in our departments for you and I, but also on the case experience, which is people's lived experience. I think there's this notion, 70 offices, nearly 20,000 employees globally. But day to day, it's your team of 5, 6, 7 people that defines your experience. If you're on the consulting side of the house, that defines your day to day experience or the people that you're working with in your team, whether your business function or on the client delivery side, that's your experience at Bain. And that unit has to work well together.
Yes, which is what makes this so hard. We can do everything from my team on paper. We can write guidelines. We can write training. We can kind of construct the right approach on paper. But really, the challenge is you have to get 20,000 people kind of embracing that and executing it at the line. Moving 20,000 people is a lot.
Moving 20,000 people is definitely a lot. Now, you mentioned your team. And one of the things that I like about Bain and working at Bain is we kind of eat our own cooking. Before we started recording, you and I were talking about, you know, I've been the client of several Bain case teams in the last year or two. But when it comes to a diverse team and one Bain, your team is very diverse. Can you talk about your team a little bit? And we'll get into a little bit more about what your role and your mandate is. But let's just talk about the team for a second.
Yeah. I mean, I think my team from a traditional vector, traditional kind of approach to diversity on paper looks very diverse, right? We've got like 5 Black women, we've got Latinas, we've got several members of Pride. I think we represent every one of our affinity groups, our 8 affinity groups. But I think beyond that piece of identity, we are just a really different and diverse group of people in terms of how we think and how we approach DEI and our styles and our strengths. And we challenge each other every day and in every meeting. And I think there's times, like I said, in which that's hard and we're living that, but I can't imagine doing what we are trying to do without the diversity of thinking and diversity of approaches that my team brings.
Yeah, what I've also found interesting is you have people that grew up at Bain, arguably like me and you, and you have some people from outside Bain, and you have people from different parts of the world and from different backgrounds. The way you define diversity was about as broad as it can be defined. And when I look at your team, I'm like, oh my goodness, that's a team? Who put that team together? That's amazing.
Yeah, I know. And it's funny, I'll tell you one specific story because I know Camilla will mind that I tell it. And so Camilla, as you know, is our director of our kind of marketing and communications within DEI. And she comes from a deep background in marketing. She is visionary and she is so creative. And so she and I were working on what we thought was the same project, which was messaging and kind of getting the right foundational messaging for our DEI work. And we were passing a document back and forth. And I kept inserting bullet points and rewriting, and I'd send it to her. And she would take out the bullet points and have this very visionary, inspiring prose and send it back to me. And I would put it back in bullet points. And finally, we got on the phone and we were talking. We were like, wait a second. I was like, what does foundational messaging mean to you? And she told me, and I was like, oh my God. Yeah. It's like, that is not what I was thinking at all. Like, we started from such different spots. You know, I was thinking about talking points, right? That we would write. Right. You know, at Bain, and she was thinking about marketing and inspiring people and what do we want people to read and then absorb and then share with the world. And so I think that's a very tactical example, but just one where, you know, she writes manifestos that are brilliant and inspiring. And I write in Bain bullet points.
I'm right there with you. And I will cut and paste those onto a PowerPoint and wow you with a presentation, maybe with a picture.
Exactly.
Well, before we go to the next segment, I just want to give a shout out to Camila, who's brought a ton of creative energy to Bain and to our DEI efforts. She sits here in Chicago with me and we catch up frequently. And Bain has certainly been a much better place with her expertise on the team.
Yes, I cannot imagine. And again, just the vision that she brings and the push and just the different perspectives. She's a great example of someone who kind of flips us on our head sometimes in terms of how we're thinking about things and makes us better.
Melissa, now that we understand today's operating principle, let's talk a little bit about your career journey and time at Bain. Can you tell us a little bit about how you grew up? I want to make sure that we get to Bain, but let's start with just your path into college and into Bain.
Yeah, so I'm a West Coaster. I grew up largely in Portland, Oregon, and then Camarillo, California. So Pacific Northwest and Southern California. I would say two kind of defining parts of my early childhood. The first was that I was actually born without a right ear. So completely deaf, but also with nothing kind of on a nose structure on that side of my head. In 2023, there will probably be a lot of medical ways to address that. In 1977, there were not. But I had four reconstructive surgeries when I was 5 and 6 that built an ear, but never restored hearing. And so, you know, I think being half deaf and also going through the experience of 4 major surgeries with kind of one very big defining point in my life. I think the other thing that has really shaped who I am and where I am today is you think about many people growing up and they kind of had one path. They went largely in one school system, kind of had the same set of folks around them. We moved several times. And my school experience was pretty different, I think, than the traditional U.S. experience. So we moved when I was in middle school to Southern California. And the middle school that I went to was actually a tiny little public school in the middle of Orange Orchards. There were only about 30 kids in my grade. And there were probably only about 4 or 5 of us that were white native English speakers. And some kids didn't actually speak English at all. And so we kind of had 30 kids all in one grade in one classroom with language barriers and huge differences in experiences, which is totally not, when you think about the stereotypical middle school experience, not what, you know, I think many people had. And then I also went to 3 different high schools in 4 years, just between moving back to Portland and trying to find my groove. So jumped around a bunch there. And then the final high school that I went to for my junior and senior year of high school was one that went co-ed my junior year. And so I was part of the first cohort of girls to go into that school. Again, junior year, not that many people are going to switch. And so there were only about 15 girls in my grade that chose to switch in. So again, just, you know, not the traditional experience. But one that I think, you know, between going to 3 different high schools, being in the vast minority in a couple of different situations was very different and very different than, you know, what I hear a lot of experiences.
So, Melissa, when you started that list of points or formative experiences, I started to ask, were your parents really protective? I had pretty major reconstructive surgery in middle school, but I don't think my parents ever babied me or coddled me about that. You know, I was back playing sports as soon as I could play sports. And you sort of talk about these surgeries at 5, 6 years old. And I'm like, oh, they probably were very protective. And they put you in a classroom that was probably pretty far outside of your norm. Does that sort of shape how you approach new situations and new people? And it sounds like from an early age, your parents just sort of threw you in and said, you'll figure it out. We're here for you, but you'll figure it out.
Yeah, I think you're right. It was all I ever knew, but yeah, you just figured out how to make it work, right? And it took me a while to realize when I was younger that not everyone was half deaf, right?
And right. Then
you know, but then I remember you're very young and you're playing, like, remember that game of telephone, right?
Yeah.
With little kids and they like whisper. My very first memories of realizing I was different was that I could only play telephone in one direction,
right?
Which for a little kid is really hard, right? But, you know, I spent almost two entire summers with huge bandages over my head. And, you know, one of the things that I also remember very clearly was standing in line at a McDonald's right after one of my surgeries. And there was someone behind us in line who was like, what's wrong with her? What's wrong with her head? Like, and was just like really aggressive. And there were some people in line that kind of moved my mom and I to a different part of the line. But that's, I think, another place where I remember, gosh, maybe I am different,
right?
There is something going on here. I think it taught me resilience, right? And, you know, all of these moves, you learn to rely on yourself a bit. And I think I have a deeper appreciation for my family, right? Because we were always there, even as we've been around.
Now, you mentioned junior and senior year at the same high school, and then you went on to college, and I know that you were an athlete. Was that a factor in that? And it's interesting that you would talk about your experiences, and I know that you're a runner, probably to this day. It's one of those sports where you get out there and you can be alone and think and get into the moment. How did you choose your college, and did you have bigger aspirations for running, or did you know you wanted to get into business?
I did know I wanted to continue running. I think running was, again, one of those kind of constants that you can do anywhere. And I don't know, there's just, to your point, there's something about long distance running that was comforting and called to me. And I had a fair amount of success junior and senior year in high school. So was able to really think about Division I running and have that opportunity. You know, Georgetown, it's funny, and I give this advice now to a lot of people as they're thinking about colleges. Georgetown was not on my initial list. You know, we were kind of doing the family trip where I think we started at Duke and we were working our way up the East Coast.
Right.
And we had family that lived outside of DC and we were staying with them. And my parents were like, you know what? We should go see Georgetown while we're on our way up the coast. And I kind of was like, really? It's not on my list. I want to go do something else. You know, typical teenager. And we got on campus and I looked around. I'm like, this just feels like this is where I want to go. This is what this feels right. And so we contacted the coach. We hadn't even talked to the coach. We contacted the coach and set up a recruiting trip. But I just felt as soon as I walked on, this is where I belong.
It's funny how that works. Now, fast forward through college a little bit, so the team doesn't get mad at me for going way off script here, but you ended up joining Bain on the back end of Georgetown. When did Bain come across your radar and how did you decide to make the decision to join it?
So I was a finance major in the undergrad business school at Georgetown. And so it would have been hard for consulting and Bain not to hit my radar, to be honest. You know, you either went into investment banking or consulting. I mean, up in business school at Georgetown. And so it was just part of my set of companies. I think, like, I interviewed with a number of firms. I loved Bain from the start, just the people that I met. I think I have a deep appreciation for just kind of walking in and feeling like I belong, right? And maybe that also comes from lots of moves, right? And I feel like I can pretty quickly suss out culture and where I might fit and where I might not. And I think Bain from the start, all the people that I met, similar to walking on campus at Georgetown, it felt like the right place.
Now, like me, you left for business school and made the decision to come back. People sort of ask why. I was like, because they paid for it. And that was my goal when I came the first time, to go someplace that would pay for business school. But here we are, in my case, 21 years after I was a free agent. When you came back, you went back into the consulting side of the house. And how did your career progress from there?
Yeah, so I did consulting for maybe 4 or 5 years. I really loved certain parts of it. But I think at a certain point for me, I started to realize that I really loved Bain and I loved the people at Bain. And I could not imagine working anywhere else because of the people, but I just didn't love my work. I didn't love the ups and downs and switching clients, you know, and projects. And I think in particular, I found myself getting jealous of clients who were at a company for years and years and working on something for years and years, right? Which I think is exactly what some consultants say they would never want to do,
right?
They love the idea of like going in and doing something new and solving something and then going and solving something. But for me, I don't know, I've always been drawn to these multi-year kind of operational, you design something and then you implement it. And so I found myself really wanting to do that for Bain rather than client work. And so that's when I started to explore moving into some internal roles where I could really work for Bain instead of clients.
Right. And I know one of the big roles that you took on when you made that transition was in our TMT practice, our tech, media, and telecom practice. Can you say a little bit more about how you ended up there? And was that an easy transition? Did you already know the folks that you'd be working with? You know, what was the team like?
Yeah. So I think this is where the theme of people at Bain is really going to start to emerge. Because I made the decision to work with our TMT practice largely because I knew I wanted to do something to really help Bain, but I knew I also wanted to continue to work with partners and senior folks that I had been working with for many years, right? And I had been maybe by chance to start, but then by design, working a lot in our tech, media, telecom practice. There were a couple of partners who actually ultimately were practice leaders of the practice, who I think had been sponsors and mentors and just great thought partners for me and leaders and role models throughout the years. And so when it came time to think about my next step, they were thinking about creating what was a regional practice role, the first regional practice role at Bain. And so it was kind of a natural step for me to move into that and continue to work with that.
Right. And some of the folks that you mentioned when we were talking about this are folks we've had on the podcast, like Hernan Ron, yes, who I'm working really closely with and will be working for in a couple months as our new talent acquisition leader, and Charles. And Charles and you actually have some history, right?
Yes. Yes. So Charles was one of my interviewers when I first got the AC position. And I found out a couple years after I was at Bain as an AC that there'd actually been a little disagreement in the interview debrief room about whether or not I was going to be a great fit for Bain. And one of the final round interviewers felt like I might not fit, that I might not be the right fit. But Charles apparently went to bat for me and said, she will absolutely be the right fit. And I feel so strongly about that, that I will take her as soon as she starts on my case. And he did. And so Charles was the first senior manager at the time. And I worked with him very consistently throughout my AC years in particular, and he remains a role model today and a friend and a colleague. And in fact, funny, all these years later, our kids actually have played soccer together during this winter indoor clinic. And so, you know, 20 years after he hired me, he and I were sitting side by side as our kids were battling in futsal.
That's awesome. So Melissa, you mentioned Charles and one of the other debrief partners during your interview saying you might not be a great fit for Bain. And I'm not sure exactly what that means. And it's one of the things that we've taken out of the debriefs. But I will say, fast forward several years and you ended up moving from the TMT practice to the social impact practice. So maybe they were figuring out that your passion would be around the work that we typically don't charge for. And from a business perspective, that might not be a good fit for Bain. But you ended up making the transition to social impact later in your journey. Let's talk about that, because that is an area that Bain invests super heavily in. But at the time, it was still emerging as the big fish that it's become.
Yeah. And I think that was one of the things that drew me to it, was it actually was not a global practice area at the time. And Bain was looking for someone to come in and create that infrastructure, right? And really have it look like any of our commercial practices. And I had experience, obviously, with being the first regional practice manager and trying to really build something. And I was really kind of starting to feel this desire to have more impact, right? And, you know, much as I was enjoying TMT, the underlying industry itself, I felt like it wasn't the type of impact that was what I wanted to have. And so moved over to start the global social impact practice at that time.
From your social impact role, you also became the director of our Global Women's Leadership Council and Global Diversity Programs for a while. And I think Julie Kaufman, who we've had on the podcast, and I've already mentioned many times to those listening, a friend and mentor for a very long time, my first supervisor at Bain, my first senior manager at Bain, But the GWLC move, how did that come about and who were you working with throughout that journey?
Yeah, so that was, I think, my biggest career pivot, was moving into that role from social impact. And so again, I loved the social impact practice and the social impact work, but really felt like at that point, as we all go throughout our careers, I think we learn over time and accumulate experiences over time that help us understand where our energy was. And, you know, I've always known my energy is with Bain and supporting Bain. But I think as I was working in social impact, I started to realize that I had a big passion for being people, right? You know, and I've had all of these relationships over time. And I think at that point, I was probably old and mature enough to realize that Bain may be one of the first places that I actually really felt like I belonged, right? That I really fit. And I think for many people, when they say that, they're like, and it's because, you know, I finally found my people, right? And everyone's like me. And right. That's not the case in Bain, actually. And I would say, look, one of the reasons that they probably thought I wasn't a good fit is because I don't have all of the same kind of styles and interests and approaches that, it, you know, all Bainies do. But I think it was that Bain loved me regardless, right? I could be myself in a way at Bain that I couldn't in other places. And I think I was fortunate to have really good role models who were also themselves, right? If I think about Charles and Hernan and, you know, Ron and Paul and others. And I think it was at that point that I started to pick my head up and understand that that wasn't the case for everyone, right? And that hit me in a pretty deep way. And it still hits me in a really deep way. It pains me because Bain is supposed to be that place, right? Bain is supposed to be the place that you come in and you are loved for who you are and you're appreciated for who you are. And there's a part of me that feels really bad that I didn't realize it for a long time, that a lot of people didn't feel that way, right? And when I started to, and I started to hear those stories, that was where I knew I had to go. And so Russ Hagee and I had more than a few conversations around how I could start to do that. And that kind of got me, that kind of pivoted to the role ultimately that I'm in today. And so it did start with the Global Women's Leadership Council and also Be Glad, now Pride, but our LGBTQ community. And so Russ kind of said, okay, when you start with helping Julie with the Global Women's Leadership Council, let's figure out what that is and let's continue to get that to the next level. And I want you to start to put some structure globally around Be Glad. He's like, there's a lot of energy, very similar to social impact, right? There's a lot of energy in local offices. But, you know, we've got some leaders globally, like Stephen Tallman, right, who are trying to create a global group. Can you come and just help put some infrastructure underneath that? And so that was the start. And so, yes, so I moved over, started working with Julie from the Global Women's Leadership Council, really thinking about gender diversity and gender diversity globally. And started to build Be Glad into kind of a formal affinity group. And then, as you well know, because that's the point that you and I really started to work closely together, it just kind of evolved from there, right? And I think as the world and as Bain, I think, started to understand what DEI really is, this role just kind of naturally started to expand. And so all of the other affinity groups came under my umbrella. And then we started to think about unconscious bias and inclusion, and then continue to kind of build the portfolio of what DEI meant and kind of under my team from there.
Yeah. And one of the things that I want to point out for people there is we're talking about diverse teams. One Bain is this operating principle, but there's also this operating principle around being at cause. And what you just described there of, I really like Bain. Bain is short of its full potential. I can't just wait for it to get there. I need to do something about it and pivot my career to actually get Bain to where I think Bain should be. That pretty much sums up accidentally for me in this discussion, two of our operating principles, and what better way of demonstrating it by you making a career pivot to be at cause and help Bain get there. So Melissa, as we start to wrap up, you started to touch on your current role as an EVP of Global Diversity and Inclusion, which you started in 2020, which was quite a tumultuous time and one of the times where I think we were on the phone very regularly. Can you talk about what your current mandate is at Bain? What's the scope of your role and what are the main priorities for your team as they stand right now, sort of a little over 3 years into the role?
Yeah. So, you know, 2020, I think, flipped DEI on its head for most organizations. And one of the things that it did at Bain was kind of force us to take a step back and really think about what do we mean and how do we approach DEI. But I think, you know, we were kind of talking about the organic growth before 2020, right? And I think DEI at Bain really grew up around affinity groups, right? Our affinity groups have been around for a very long time. We continue to formalize them and, you know, put infrastructure. But in 2020, we took a step back and said, you know, what does DEI really mean for Bain, right? And it means that we want to build a diverse team, an inclusive organization in which everyone feels belonging, support, and trust, right? And we set ambitions around what that meant for us globally, and then thought through, if we want to reach those ambitions as a firm, what are the key levers that we need to pull, if you will? I know that sounds very consultancy, but what do you need to do to realize those ambitions? And so the two big areas that we focus on now are ensuring that we have an equitable talent journey for every Bain, which really encompasses, you know, how we hire, how we onboard, how we train, how we assess performance, how we promote, making sure that we are mitigating bias and ensuring that our outcomes are equitable across our entire talent journey. And then the other bucket is ensuring inclusive culture. And as we were talking about at the beginning, making sure that every team at Bain is one in which someone feels like they can go in and contribute their best work. Those are two very broad buckets. And I think the other key piece, that kind of the key pivot that we made in 2020, was explicitly recognizing that the majority of what I just described cannot be done solely by my team, right? And in fact, it has to be embedded throughout the organization. Because you sitting in talent acquisition, you need to own, you know, ensuring that we are hiring a very diverse set of talent, mm-hmm. right? As we think about our performance assessment process, we need to really build that process in a way that it is equitable for all Bains, right? And that sits within the team that really covers that. You know, my team advises, we bring expertise, we're a center of excellence, but we cannot do it alone. You know, and as you, I think, very importantly said at the beginning of the podcast, the experience and inclusive culture, that is felt in the team, in someone's team every day. We can't create an inclusive culture sitting here, you and I. And so it's really an all of us, all the time activity. And so one of the big things that we've been focused on over the last couple of years is embedding DEI into everything we do as a firm, which is a very different muscle and a very different approach than, you know, I think a lot of organizations are taking.
Yeah, that all of us all the time mindset that is being preached globally by your team and making us all responsible for it is something that it is a really tough culture shift. I would tell my recruiters back when we were really going through the formation of that mindset in 2020, you can't tell me that you're getting the best people from your campus if half of the campus doesn't feel like women can thrive at Bain, if a quarter of the campus doesn't feel like underrepresented minorities can thrive at Bain. Therefore, as a recruiter, you can't outsource it to a diversity recruiting team. Yes. If you're the recruiter for this campus, you're responsible for the whole campus. It sounds obvious, but that's not how people operate. They say, well, I recruit basically straight white men, and everybody else the diversity team is responsible for. Yes. I'm like, that's not how it works. I'm proud to say that I think we are well past that now in our journey. Yes. But it was interesting that the actions would demonstrate that the mindset wasn't where it needed to be. And your team, more than any other team, I think, has taken us further, faster than a lot of us could have imagined. So thank you. And thank you for being on the podcast today.
Thank you.